So good afternoon, Professor Fröhlich. As we were just discussing, we're going to be having a discussion about the history of replica symmetry breaking and spin glasses in physics, a period that we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. But before we delve into the heart of the topic, we have a few background questions that we'd like to ask to better situate your own contributions. The first one is, what originally drew you to the physics of phase transitions in particular?
All right. Well, maybe let's phrase the question as follows. What drew me to statistical mechanics? So when I was a PhD student, I had just started to work on my thesis. There was a Lesueur school in 1970 that was devoted to statistical mechanics and quantum field theory. And among the people in statistical mechanics, the lecturers were Jean Ginibre, whom you might know at least by name. He was a very brilliant, very intelligent, and extremely decent colleague who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. Then there was Bob Griffiths from Carnegie Mellon, Andrew Lennard from Bloomington, Indiana, Elliot Leeb, then from MIT, nowadays he's at Princeton, and David Ruelle from the IHES. And they gave, really wonderful lectures. And of course, that sort of provoked my interest in matters of statistical mechanics. In fact, when I passed my PhD exam, my thesis was about quantum field theory. But during the exam, my advisor, Klaus Hepp, ask questions about statistical mechanics, in particular about the Pyle's argument, which deals with the phase transition in the Ising model. Later on, I was a postdoctoral researcher, first at Harvard and then at Princeton as an assistant professor. And I arrived at Princeton at the same time when Elliot Leeb arrived as a professor. And so we had a lot of interactions, and he gave a seminar for friends of statistical mechanics practically every semester. So obviously, I got interested. In fact, I also gave some graduate course at Princeton about statistical mechanics. And then, in about, when was it, 1975, Barry Simon, who was also a colleague at Princeton, suggested that he, Tom Spencer, and I tried to work on phase transitions. And the obvious problem then was to try to show that there are phase transitions accompanied by continuous symmetry breaking and the emergence of Goldstone bosons. And this looked like an extremely tough problem. And in the end, we found a very elegant and technically rather simple solution, which is still, some of the ingredients we developed are still in heavy use nowadays. It's these infrared bounds, which are a statistical mechanics analog of the Jellin-Lehmann representation in quantum field theory. So that's how I got started. Another piece of work I did a little before that was about two-dimensional Coulomb gases. There, of course, there is also a phase transition, namely the Castellet-Thales transition, but I couldn't do the Castellet-Thales transition yet, but at least I did some initial steps in that direction. And eventually, Spencer and I established the Castellet-Thales transition in 1980. So that's roughly how my trajectory in statistical mechanics started.
In your Selecta book, which came out about 13 years ago, you described the mathematical physics as a very useful endeavor in at least two different situations. The first being when the progress in discovering the new laws of nature is stagnating, and second, when deep conceptual problems turn up that call for a radical rethinking of the foundations of physical theory. So in which of these two categories would you generally situate your contributions to statistical mechanics and phase transitions more specifically?
Oh, obviously, in category one, you see, when I was just a little too young to participate in the big revolution that happened in particle physics in connection with the discovery of the Standard Model and asymptotic freedom and the like. And so my feeling was that not too much was happening there, but there were still lots of interesting problems for mathematical physicists to try their teeth on. And one of them, of course, was phase transitions. However, I believe I have also done work on category two, namely rethinking foundations, but that came much later and is connected to quantum theory, not to phase transitions.
So you described a bit how you came to work on phase transitions and statistical mechanics, but in generally, how did you find problems, or what drove your interests in jumping from one to the other?
Yes, the word jumping is well chosen. I think maybe, of course, Dyson. Dyson always complained that his attention span was very short and therefore he had to move from one problem to another one. I'm somewhat similar in this respect. I never worked on any particular problem for a very long period of time. Perhaps until I retired. Now, during the past 10 years, I've been fairly steady on certain problems. So I liked to move from one area to another one. And that's simply how I have proceeded. This was still possible during my time. I didn't have to specialize very much. Nowadays, I think people like myself are considered to be somewhat unprofessional. But during my lifetime as an active scientist, this was tolerated. In fact, it was perhaps even a certain asset.
So was it largely through chance encounters with other scientists, or through steady reading of the literature, or
actually a fairly slow reader. I have never read very much. Of course, sometimes it's unavoidable. You have to learn something, then you have to read up. But I'm a slow reader. I got my inspiration more from attending talks, attending summer schools. For example, Les Ouches, I always thought was a wonderful place to get the inspiration, but also in colloquia and in seminars and so on. And then I was very lucky in having some people I really liked to talk to. For example, when I was at Princeton as an assistant professor, that was during a period when Erhard Seil of the Max Planck Institute of Munich was there as a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study. And we had absolutely wonderful discussions that I found extremely stimulating. For example, it is certainly to some extent thanks to Erhard Seil that I got started on the two-dimensional Coulomb gas. Actually, this was an attempt to understand Sine-Gordon theory, but it turned out, and this was largely explained to me by Erhard Seiler, that it was connected to the two-dimensional Coulomb gas, and then that sort of triggered my interest in the two-dimensional Coulomb gas. And then afterwards, I got in touch with Tom Spencer, and we had a very successful collaboration for several years.
So your first paper on spin glasses proper was a collaboration with Ernest van Enter, whom I think you understand you met at the Les Ouches school in 1984. As part of that school, you were already, however, lecturing on spin glasses, if I understand correctly. So when did spin glasses enter your field of vision, and in what context?
So, I spent 4.5 years at IHES as a professor permanent, but then I sort of got pulled back towards my home institution, which is ETH in Zurich. And there I had a lot of PhD students, and I needed to generate good problems for theses. And, spin glasses were sort of in the air. And I had one student, Anton Bovier, who who developed an interest in working on that. And so that's how we got started. But I have to confess that I never found spin glasses incredibly interesting or important, to be honest. But, you know, it was a circle of problems that seemed to be interesting to work on together with PhD students.
So did you just say to your student, go study this field, or you already had absorbed part of the literature?
I mean, now? I had some background knowledge, and at the beginning of my time at ETH, I always ran a weekly working seminar, and we would present interesting problems to one another, and my students would report on the progress they were making and so on. So that's how this came about.
So do you remember which papers in particular? Were these the works of Parisi, or were they the earlier works that were...
I'm not sure anymore, but I think I already heard about spin glasses when I was at Princeton. You know, the Edwards Anderson spin glass was something that was discussed, and so I had some idea about what these spin glasses were about and what some of the interesting problems were about. I think the Parisi solution, I'm not sure anymore when I first heard it, maybe at the Garges school. I think Parisi mentioned that in Garges, if I remember correctly. But in fact, originally my first attempts were directed towards understanding spin glasses in finitely many dimensions. In fact, easing spin glasses with short-range couplings. That was my main interest initially. This also had something to do with, you know, similarities of the spin glass problem to certain problems in lattice gauge theory. And lattice gauge theory was very much on my mind during that period.
So could you elaborate a bit on that point? What were these similarities that you were seeing?
You know, you can view the random exchange couplings in a spin glass as frozen configurations of a gauge field. There's a gauge invariance. You can change the couplings. Gauge transforms the couplings and simultaneously gauge transform the spins on the sides, and that leaves the measure of the spin, the equilibrium measure of the spin glass invariant. And now, of course, in lattice gauge theory, you integrate over the gauge fields, which means you look at annealed models, while in the spin glass problem, the gauge fields are quenched. So obviously these are two different problems. Nevertheless, some of the formal aspects of these two problems were sort of somewhat similar, and that played a certain role in my getting interested in the spin glass problem. In fact, in my work with Bouvier, the idea of the gauge invariance played a fairly significant role.
I see. So as you mentioned yourself, you moved from finite dimensional or short range spin glasses to long range spin glass when you started working with I think a postdoc at ETH, or Boguslav.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you explain to us that transition and that interest?
I do not remember the details, but at some point, Sigalinski, you know, we had lots of discussions, and at some point, Sigalinski told me, well, he was now interested in spin glasses and he had an idea of how to deal with long-range spin glasses. And so we started to work on it. And I think we did, you know, we found some fairly nice results on long-range spin glasses. And then at some point, we noticed that some of our ideas would also apply to the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. And so we wrote the paper. Our paper was maybe perhaps the first verification that there really is a phase transition in the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. However, our methods did not reveal the very tantalizing low temperature structure of the equilibrium states, it just showed that there is a phase transition. And it gave insight into the high temperature regime, of course. But that's much easier than the low temperature regime.
So is there a specific way in which your expertise that you'd built up to that point helped you attack this problem, or this was a new set of tools altogether?
Well, you know, I was familiar with many methods in statistical mechanics, in particular cluster expansions, high temperature cluster expansions, low temperature expansions, the Pyle's argument, the Pirogov-Sinai, and so on. I also knew about correlation inequalities. I had a decent background in analysis and a somewhat less decent background in probability theory. But in any event, I had enough sort of tools in my bag to think that we could successfully work on such problems. I have to say, you know, very often in my professional life, I came up with problems and with some ideas of how one might attack them, but I was fortunate to have good collaborators who would sort of, you know, tighten the screws and come up with technical ideas that probably I would never have found. And Segal Linsky was one of them. I mean, he was, a very strong young mathematician, and he had lots of good technical ideas about these things that played a role in our joint work.
So as you mentioned, that work largely improved the existence of a phase transition, but also largely considered the high temperature phase transition. Was the Parisi solution of any help or intuition in devising your approach, or was this completely independent?
Oh, this was, I think, completely independent. Although we had heard about Parisi's ideas, and, you know, it was sort of mysterious and somewhat fascinating and so on, but we really didn't understand what it all meant. So it was our work had essentially nothing to do with Parisi's work. The first time I had an extended discussion with Parisi was in, just a second, 58, in 82, I guess, 83, namely on the 25th anniversary of Wolfgang Pauli's death. ETH organized a memorial conference, and I suggested to invite Parisi, and in fact, he was invited and attended, and he stayed for an extra day or two, and then the main subject of the discussion was his ideas about Sherrington-Kirkpatrick. Unfortunately, I think I was both not sufficiently intelligent and not sufficiently motivated to actually really look into the details of the Parisi solution. And that never changed, unfortunately.
So,
unfortunately, who knows?
How was your work on the high temperature phase received at the time?
So, you see, there was a competing paper, and to the best of my knowledge, we were completely independent. The competing paper was Eisenman, Leibowitz, and Ruel. They also showed that there was a phase transition in the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. I tend to think we got this, somewhat more detailed results than they did. Nevertheless, the sort of main upshot of both papers was the existence of this phase transition. And, since Leibowitz and Ruel and so on were big shots at the time, I think their paper was got much more widely disseminated than ours. In fact, it's a little ironic. I have a colleague here in Zurich, a probabilist, Erwin Bolthausen, who also did quite a lot of work on spin glasses. And he wrote the review and didn't quote us. Then I told him, that's not very long ago, then I told him I thought it was a little strange, since we were, you know, sort of almost next door scientists in Zurich. And then he said he never heard about our paper. So I think it never became very well known, as far as I can tell.
So you knew Ruel from L'Institut des Écoles, and you knew Michael Eisenman because you'd worked with him. Were you completely unaware of each other's work at that point?
Absolutely unaware, because I was here in Zurich and Zegalinski was with me, and we didn't hear about their attempts until their paper came out, which was when our paper was already essentially finished. Mm. So it was really totally independent.
So afterwards, you largely left the field of spinning glasses. What other problems drew you away then?
Oh, so let's see. That was sort of, in the mid-80s or so. Then I started to get interested in bait statistics. So in 1987, I got interested in sort of bait statistics and anions and so on, I think in 86. And that already was somewhat motivated by my desire to understand the quantum Hall effect. And then I had some pretty good ideas about braids and that there were these exotic quantum statistics and so on. And then in 87, in the spring, I had a sabbatical, which I spent at IHES. And luckily, Warren Jones was there. Warren Jones, I knew from my time when I was at IHES. He was then a PhD student in Geneva of André Heflicker. And André Heflicker told him he should occasionally visit IHES and talk to Alain Cohn about, mathematics problems. And I discovered when I re-met him at IHES in 1987 that he knew a lot about, braids and Young Baxter and so on. And he was a wonderfully generous person. So he gave me all his seminar notes, and that helped me a lot to sort of work out my ideas about braid statistics. And of course, I knew that this would be also relevant in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So the next several years, I mostly spent working on braid statistics, then super selection sectors in two- and three-dimensional quantum field theories, and also applications to constructing invariants for knots and links and so on. And I may say, this is maybe not so well known, but it's a fact, I think I was the first who had the idea that Chern-Simon theory would provide invariants for knots and links. Unfortunately, I encountered some problems in my calculation. And then Edward Witten's paper came up about Chern-Simons and invariants for knots and links, which sort of stole me the show, but that can happen. In any event, I then went on with my calculations. And again, thanks to meeting somebody who was, technically maybe stronger than I, Christopher King of Northeastern, we managed to finish the sort of strategy that I had tried to apply to this problem. So that's really what happened. I sort of left statistical mechanics for some time in favor of fundamental, quantum statistics, conformal field theory, and the like.
So did you not have a program to pursue in spinning glass beyond these high temperature phase
Not really, no. The idea that there can be systems in statistical mechanics that offer a very complicated landscape of equilibrium states and ground states, that was, of course, that was an idea that was already known and circulating, and I found it interesting. But I simply, first, I did not think that the spin glass problem was particularly important. It was not particularly interesting for me. And furthermore, it seemed to me I didn't have a chance to make a really useful contribution, so I didn't pursue it. And, you know, you probably know Marc Mézard. So he was, of course, contacted when Parisi got the Nobel Prize. And one of his comments was that the SK model is completely uninteresting, but the methods developed to solve it, to understand it, are unbelievably interesting. And that sort of also summarizes my own feelings.
So did you nevertheless keep abreast of the advances in the field after you left, or this was a sharp cut?
Just in, you know, listening to people. So I'm sure I must have heard Parisi's story several times in different places. But then I also heard Talleyrand at some point in the Ticino in Monte Verità. There is a conference center above Ascona, and Michel Talleyrand was invited to give some lectures there, and that was certainly very interesting, although it seemed to me it was technically you know, well above what I usually do.
In your Selecta again, you wrote that if you could, you would rather exploit the huge potential of the methods of Parisi and his followers for applications to problems in other fields rather than work again on the finite dimensional versions of the SK model or the Edwards Anderson model. Can you please expand a bit on your reasoning for that impression?
Well, I didn't remember that I wrote such a thing, but you have obviously reminded me of that. It, you know, it goes in the same direction as Mézard's remark. I think, you know, the replica symmetry breaking and the cavity method and the ultrametricity of the space of equilibrium states and so on. These are ideas which obviously have found lots of interesting applications to other problems. And I'm glad that people have, you know, worked it out and pushed it. But I'm not one of them.
At your time at ETH or elsewhere, did you ever teach about spinning glasses or replica symmetry breaking?
No. I've not given a single talk about replica symmetry breaking. I've been interested in the replica method and also in its cousin, namely to introduce Grassmann variables and sort of, you know, make the model super symmetric, to which serves to calculate quenched averages. So that has been of interest to me. And in fact, in some other work, I have applied such ideas, but at the technical level, much lower than what happened in the SK model.
And did you give lectures, for instance, about your work on the high temperature phase before you left, or this was just the papers? And
did I give lectures? I would not exclude that I have given some seminars about my work with Segalinski in particular. I gave a seminar about my work with Bouvier at Bell Labs. And there was a young guy in the audience whose name is David Hughes. And after my talk, he told me, you know, whenever I hear about spin glasses, it seems to me nobody understands anything about it. But not long afterwards, he started to work with Daniel Fischer. And, you know, I feel their work was not more interesting than my work with Bouvier. Two people who did make some relevant contributions that I think went beyond what Bouvier and I did were Chuck Newman and Don Stein, or is it Stein?
Yes.
I don't remember his first name, maybe Don.
Anyway, Stein, yes.
So they did some nice work. In fact, I have a lot of respect for Chuck Newman. I don't know Stein, but I know Chuck Newman also well. As you might know, he also did a lot of very nice work on SLE in recent years.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us about that era that we may have missed or overlooked?
The era of, you mean, of the
of your work on Spinglass, yes.
No, I think no. All I could add is, if you know, for a while I was at the research institute, namely IHES, working primarily with Tom Spencer, but also with just by myself, with our collaborators. If I had stayed there, I would never have touched Spinglasses. It was just the need to have nice problems for PhD students that made me suggest some of these problems and work on some of these problems. But I confess that I did not find these questions particularly profound or fundamental for physics. I still think that's, in fact, the right assessment. I think these methods are more interesting in fields that are not directly related to physics, like, you know, certain optimization problems, operations research, and so on. And I'm, in my heart, a physicist. I like to work on deep problems of physics, and Spinglasses did not look like a particularly profound problem of physics.
In closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
You know, if I can sort of move my computer a little bit, and you may see how much literature is on these bookshelves. So I have thousands of transparencies and thousands of pages of notes. I have lecture notes from my lectures at ETH, probably 4,000 pages. Everything unpublished. So I'm pretty sure if I went through all the stuff that is on my bookshelves, I might find some old notes on Spinglasses, but I'm not able to locate them right now. And I did not have plans to, you know, make them public. I sometimes played with the idea of perhaps scanning my course notes. I think rather nice notes on quantum field theory, quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, and so on. But so far, it's all in the private domain, not public.
Will ETH take your archives, your papers, or is that not?
I have no idea. I should never ask them. I think, you know, nowadays I could scan them. Mm-hmm. I've been a little too lazy to stand at the scanning machine and scan all the thousands of pages, but maybe I should do it at some point. Although I'm not sure that, you know, there is too much literature circulating nowadays, and much of it is garbage, and so I don't want to contribute to that.
Professor Fröhlich, thank you very much for this conversation.
Well, it was a pleasure to discuss with you. I hope you have heard everything that I can contribute to this particular subject.